As part of the IRW project to record on tape some of the early history of radio and electronics in South Australia, I'm speaking today with Mr. Bill Walker. Welcome, Bill. Perhaps we might commence by you telling us something about how you first got interested in the intricacies of radio.
Went for grade 6 and 7, I went to Lefevre's Peninsula School, and mother and father and I lived with grandmother and two maiden aunts in Exeter. And in grade 7 year, our teacher had a wireless set. He also had a telescope. Well, now, this didn't make much impact on me. Teachers did things like that. But, oh yes, I think that the family moved to Cheltenham before the end of the school year, and I continued to go to Lefevre's school. One afternoon I was walking from school towards the Glanville railway station with one of my classmates, Ron Ledger by name, and I had a mechano set and a little steam engine to drive the models, and I found that Ron had a steam engine which he'd made himself, whereas mine had been given to me, so this I had to see. So alright, I decided to miss that train and go and have a look at Ron's steam engine, and it was a very nice little steam engine, and something was said, and he had a wireless set too. Well, so we went and had a look at that. 5DN were on the air, of course, and 5CL I should think was on, and VIA of course was on Spark in those days. It got into everything. Well, I should think it was during the school holidays. I thought, yeah, maybe I could build one of those things. If Ron can do it, why can't I? So I, at this stage, I don't remember where I got the wire or the crystal, but they were obtainable if you went to the right places. And there was no shortage of pieces of wood, because in those days, kerosene came in 4-gallon cans in wooden cases, nice American timber. But the coil was wound on a cylindrical former. The Walker household didn't seem to have anything in the way of cylindrical formers. But at last I came upon a self-vital tin, which was just about the right size. So all right, I made up a baseboard and two ends, and a few nails to anchor the self-vital tin in place, and wound my coil. Found some varnish among father's treasures and varnished it in place and scraped a strip down the side for the slider to run on, and I must admit it was a very crude holder for the crystal and the cat's whisker. Took it down to my friend Ron in Exeter to try it out, and it didn't work for some reason or other. He didn't know, and I didn't know why it didn't work. Well, I don't know how much time elapsed before I got around to trying again, but I presume I got my hands on a piece of timber next time, because as we realise these days, if you wind radio coils on metallic cylindrical formers, they just don't work.
I was going to ask you, actually. I thought it might have been when they had cardboard walls in them, some of the tins in those days, didn't they?
Well, that's what I should have found.
Yes.
But the Walker household didn't own anything like that. The aunts drank tea. Don't think we had any cocoa or coffee. Surely we didn't have coffee. Anyway, sometime later in the piece, I got hold of a suitable former and made a new coil. And of course, by now I was going to high school and handy to Rundle Street. And in Rundle Street, you could buy things like crystal detectors and the bar and the slider to run along and things like this. So eventually I got round to making another crystal set. Twisted father's arm, I would think, for a pair of headphones. We put up two masts. Each mast was two lengths of half-inch water pipe. And I don't know why father had invested his money in a coil of hard-drawn fencing wire. And we used this for the guys. It was abominable stuff. Anyway, we got
how high were the masts?
around about 20-25 feet, I would think. Like a length of half inch pipe, something like 12 foot. And brought the aerial in through the kitchen window, and lo and behold, the thing worked. So there we were. And, I guess I built one or two crystal sets. I don't think I ever built any valve sets while we were at Cheltenham. Well, the house was somewhat crowded with all of us in it, so Father got to work and raised all the money we could get our collective hands on and built a house in Alberton. So we moved down to Alberton in the middle of 1926. And I had a room to myself there, luxury. And the builder built in a couple of drip tubes, porcelain tubes, through the wall for me. The neighbours at the back, one worked in a timber mill in Port Adelaide, and the other guy was a rough bush carpenter with the emphasis on the rough. So it was no trouble to get a 30-foot length of 3x3 Oregon and get the corners taken off it and bolt it to the back fence. And I was in business
again. Up went another aerial,
eh? Crystal set.
Hmm. How do we progress from there then to get into the business?
Time went on. I don't know just where. Phillips put out some double grid valves, two grids in the one envelope. And this meant that this thing worked with a very low high tension voltage. Something like 9 volts was ample for it. I believe that the first grid was used as a space charge grid. It coaxed the electrons out of the filament and sent them on their way towards the anode. Mm. Whereas, as I was told many years later, if you don't have that space charge grid, it takes considerable work, considerable high voltage applied to coax the electrons to leave the hot filament. Anyway, the one valve set worked very nicely. Regeneration, of course. I hope that somewhere there I got myself a variable tuning condenser. So that was quite a successful set, but of course it only drove a pair of headphones. Incidentally, I can't remember just how I managed to light the filaments of this tube. I still have a strong dislike for lead acid accumulators. Some person, what's the word, parodied a bit from The Merchant of Venice. You know, the speech about the quality of mercy is not strained. And this gentleman wrote this little ditty about the strength of battery as it is not known. It falleth like the gentle rain from heaven upon the floor beneath. It curses he who sweeps and she who dusts. I'd agree with him.
Yeah,
anyway. After a time, I acquired another one of these little double grid valves. And somebody told me that you needed a 5-to-1 interstage transformer. So I acquired a 5-to-1 transformer. But the audio amp was not exactly a dead loss, but it certainly had no gain at all.
Mm.
And of course, I didn't know what was wrong with the thing. The audio stage on its own seemed to respond to the usual putting your fingers on grid terminals and things. But anyway, I took it into Crooks and Brookers in Rundle Street and asked them to have a look at it and see what was wrong with it. I don't think they were much ahead of me, but anyway, they gave it back to me for, I guess, some financial reward. It had a pair of ordinary triodes in it, and it worked. But of course it needed a couple of high-tension batteries, which cost money. Once again, I don't know just how I lit the filaments of those tubes. Somewhere there I acquired a 4-volt lead acid accumulator in a celluloid case. And down at Alberton there was a garage not terribly far away, so it's possible that every now and then I lugged this beautiful accumulator across the road to the garage and got it charged.
You had electricity in your house at that time,
didn't you? Yes. But in those days, rectifiers were fairly rare animals. A lot of the amateurs used what they called S-tubes, which were some variety of gaseous conduction thing. And I suppose the old 280 was probably available by then. But now that wasn't much good for charging an accumulator.
No. Right, and how did we get on from there? Did we? This is, would be, you'd still be at school at this time when you...
Yes. Oh, yes, incidentally, the original crystal installation I left behind at Cheltenham with a pair of headphones, I must have been feeling financial, and I bought from somebody in Rundle Street a pair of Baldwin headphones, magnificent headphones. They had a rocking armature assembly with a mica diaphragm and a rocking armature which was energised, I suppose is the word, by a thunderbolt magnet. The earpieces were at least 2¼ inches diameter and about 2 inches deep to accommodate this thunder great magnet.
They'd be pretty heavy on the head, wouldn't they?
They were, yes. And years later, I went to move Brown's school to master the telegraphy. There was a pair of Baldwins there, and of course I picked them up and slammed them on, having been used to them all for many years. Got a chorus of jeers from the rest of the guy, you know, a brave man taking on the weightlifting game.
And what about the work situation, Bill? How did you get involved in the work, as a career?
Well, the Walker family had come out from Scotland to Port Adelaide in the early days. Grandfather was a sea captain, and quite a few of the people in Port Adelaide were Scots also. Among them was the Lesk family. Jack Lesk was assistant main superintendent of the Adelaide Electric Supply Company in those days. So one of my aunts and I went out to talk to Mr. Lesk and tell him the story that I was looking for a job at the end of my third year of high school. He in turn put in a word for me with Mr. Giles, who was the meter superintendent. I went down and talked to Mr. Giles while I was still at high school. He said, come back at the end of the year when you've got your... Well, you know what your exam results are. So I went back and talked to him. Oh, yes, yes, we could use a young man like you in the meter section. So January 1928, I started at Hilton with the old supply company.
And that's first still year, where it is now. Still in that same place, is it? Hilton?
Well, the buildings are still there, yes. Mm. Yep. Burbridge Road these days. In those days, the firm had just introduced a training course. I think it had started the year before, and the average school leaver had a set course, I think 2 or 3 years at the School of Mines on elementary electricity. Those of us like myself that had been to high school and had certificates were allowed to go on for, an associateship of the School of Mines, I think it was, in electrical engineering. So I started off doing drawing one and fitting one, and electrical engineering one and maths one and so on. We used the guys doing the company course, I think, had 4 hours off in the firm's time. I think that was all they were expected to do, but those of us that were looking for higher things, I think we got our 4 hours off in the firm's time, but we were expected to do 4 hours in our own time. And I must have been keen or greedy or something. I'm pretty sure I was doing more than 4 hours. I know that one 4 hours was during the firm's time, but that was a couple of subjects in the daytime. And I did a couple of subjects at night.
It would have been fairly rare in those times for the firms to give people time off to go to school, wouldn't it? Or was it common?
Well, the people I'd gone to public school with, for instance, a lot of them were apprenticed to people like Perry's at Mile End and Horwood Bagshaw, and I think they went to an apprentice training school, but they probably only got 2 hours a week or something like that. But it went on. Of course, they had on-the-job training to a large extent. They had a master, like one of the guys I knew was a pattern maker. Well, there was a senior pattern maker, and he watched over all his kids that started and showed them the way it should be done. All they went, when they went to school, they got the theoretical part of it. The expansion of metals went hot and that sort of thing.
And what about the training that you had for the meters? Did you have, were you just a trainee doing the meter repairs, or was it building meters or repairing them?
No, testing and yeah. adjusting. Yes, they had a mechanical workshop that did any mechanical alterations, but most of the meters only need a clean and reassembly and adjustment.
Mm.
Oh yes, the test room was mainly staffed with first year mechanics in training.
Right.
We had a boss who had many years of experience in the work, a couple of senior adult meter testers.
Right, and where'd we go from there then?
Well, the next year I got transferred to fixing meters. There was a motor car, obviously, that carried the installation inspector and the meter fixer, and occasionally a lad to assist and learn, and a box on the back in which we stowed a dozen or so meters and our tools and supplies of solder and things like that, and the ladder strapped on the driver's side of the car. And we went out and fixed meters in people's premises. The lad's job was usually to take the ladder and climb up at the service point, and if necessary put the live outer in the company's fuse box, although usually the lineman did that, but take the consumer's outer and put that in the consumer's side of the fuse box and make a joint on the neutral. Occasionally careless lads made the joint on the outer instead of the neutral, and great was the abuse that flowed from the guy inside who put his finger on it.
Yes, but, because most of the meters would have been inside the house in those days,
yes,
wouldn't they?
Yes, practically always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, even if you go around Prospect, for instance, you'll see houses now, you can see the old drip tube. The company used to run its mains down to a couple of insulators and then in through a drip tube, and the company's fuse was inside the house.
Mm.
From one point of view, it was a jolly good thing, because those old fuse boxes in the middle of winter were decidedly ticklish.
Yeah.
It wasn't funny when you were standing on the top of a pair of burrowed steps and you reached, and it was nicely wet from having been out in the rain for a couple of days, and you reached up and touched the fuse box and it tickled. I never really appreciated that.
Bill, I believe there was a certain amount of DC still around then, was there? Not all.
Yes, quite a bit. The city of Adelaide, of course, was DC right back to 1901 or 2 or whenever it was. But they soon learned that places like North Adelaide, for instance, the voltage drop on DC was too noticeable to be desirable even in North Adelaide. And, of course, to reach out to places like Norwood and Unley, it was obviously impractical, so they started running AC, single phase AC, and they ran 4,000 volt high tension mains, two wires, and stepped it down to 400 volt centre tap with a centre tapped earthed neutral. The supply to Port Adelaide, of course, was further again, and I think there must have been a considerable load at Port Adelaide, so they doubled the voltage. Instead of having 4,000 volts single phase, probably with no intentional earth on it, they ran 2 by 4,000 with the centre point earthed. And down at Port Adelaide they had a synchronous converter, a synchronous motor actually, for power factor correction to keep the line losses to a minimum. And then, you possibly might remember, the first year we were at high school, the Grenfell Street DC plant was closed down, and some of our chaps came back to school with pieces of transformer iron and commutator segments and things like this from the old DC station. But the city itself was still on DC because they built a rotary converter station behind the old power station. And there was a number of great big rotary converters there. And that carried on up until about 1936, I think. But the company was vigorously changing it over from DC to AC. There were still parts of the city. I can remember Colton, Palmer and Preston had a DC lift. Lifts were a very awkward thing. It was almost impossible to a printing press, for instance, you could lift the motor out and select a motor of the right size and speed and get a new gear wheel or a new belt pulley and bolt the new motor down and you were in business. But a blanky lift, the lift motor itself was usually a specialised motor, and the brake mechanism and the control gear was all specialised stuff, so you finished up with giving the firm a brand new lift, and the whole supply company weren't that keen to replace lifts if they could help it. They preferred to sit and wait, and the customer would eventually find that his lift was out of date and he would replace it with his own free will.
Okay, so that was in the trust, and how long did you stay with the electricity, Adelaide Electric Supply Company then, wasn't it?
It was when I started, yes, up until 1940.
Yeah, and were you with them until then?
Yes, yes.
Were you always in the meter section, or did you work in other areas as well?
Yes, there was one period, I was at Hilton in the meter section 1928-29, as I said, out on cars fixing meters in 1929. At the end of that year, I got put on to no supply calls. If some customer rang up and complained that he had no electricity, we would go out and find out why and replace the fuse or do elementary repairs to get him going again. And then January 1930, I think, somewhere there, I got transferred down to Port Adelaide. There was a line depot at Port Adelaide, so I was under the immediate supervision of the line foreman and his assistant, and another chappie and I worked alternate day and evening shifts, doing no supply calls. And when there was no calls to go out to, we stuck around and jointed up reclaimed copper and sawed off condemned poles. Things like this generally did useful work for the firm.
Right.
It wasn't a bad job. Well, overall it wasn't a bad job. It had its moments though, of course. As I've said before, this standing on top of somebody else's stepladder trying to get a fuse out of a live box, that wasn't funny enough. The sort of thing that used to get under my skin to a certain extent. There were two emergency call-out gangs. Jack Cranner, my offsider, normally worked with one pair who were teetotalers. And the luck of the draw, I worked with a pair of villains who were good, solid drinkers. If you had a job for Dave and his mate Bob, any time up to 6:20, you knew where they were. They were thoroughly reliable. They were in the Newmarket Hotel. And as likely as not, if you called them from there onwards, they would arrive quite happy and contented. What used to tend to get under my skin, I'd go out to a job somewhere, find that there was no supply to a house because there was a wire down in the street. I'd go back and ring up the storeman and get him to call Dad and Dave and Bob out. And I'd go back and stand by this infernal wire. Of course, it would be raining frequently. I stand there as wet as a shag. They'd turn up happily lubricated. Leave it to us, boy. She'll be right. And as likely as not, by the time they arrived, the moon had come out and the rain had stopped. I'd get home thoroughly soaked. They'd be as dry as can be. Oh, dead funny.
Bill, when did the conversion from 200 volt to 240 volt for houses start?
Well, I came back to the city January 1934, and I went to the Adelaide Hospital to work there. That was in the process of being changed from DC to 240 volts AC. But that was a long, slow process because we had motors to change and considerable rearrangement of wiring and that sort of thing. And I reckon I was there for at least 3 months. And then we started, I reckon about March 1934, we started on a survey. A character by the name of Ira Toop and I walked the streets of Adelaide in certain areas with our notebooks and our stack of forms signed by the managing director telling the customers that the supply company was changing the supply from 200 to 240 and all the costs would be borne by the company, and we would like to find out what they had, what needed to be changed. We would come away with a list of the gear they had, the number and size of lamps and their domestic smoothing iron, and a radio set if they had one, a fan if they had one. That was, now, most ordinary residents, that was about all they had. Occasionally you would find a man who had perhaps a little motor to drive a saw or something like that. But I reckon 90% of the houses had lighting and a smoothing iron, a fan possibly, and occasionally a radio. I remember seeing on Mr. Giles' desk one day, I think that must have been in the first year, I reckon, one of the jobs that fell to the first year juniors in the meter test shop was to sweep the office floor before the boss got in. And one day on the boss's desk there was this page out of a magazine, some power authorities mag, saying that now this radio business is not really the sort of thing that should be of great interest to power authorities. These things only use a minute amount of power. They're only toys at the best of things. Even by 1936, I suppose a fair number of residents has had radio receivers. But anyway, Ira and I toddled around the streets of Adelaide. The mains department would nominate a certain block of houses where they were going to change the supply, and we would go to that area and come out with our lists, and the clerical staff would make sure that stores had sufficient bits and pieces. And then I reckon Ira and I spent about a year on the survey only, and I should think mid-1935 we started actually changing down in the southeastern corner of the city. And in those days we could usually find a disused garage or a disused warehouse or something like that as our basis to work from.
So you just take the appliances out of the people's homes and change the transformers or whatever, then return them and carry on to the next place.
Yes. Mm. And it would take us up to a week probably to prepare an area. And in those days we used to carefully change all the lamps. And of course with 240 volt lamps with only 200 on them, they were rather dim. And yes, some of the radio sets didn't behave themselves too well with only 200 on the 240 volt tap. But that was the way we did it in the city. Well, that kept me happily employed up until mid-1937, I would think. And then there was a pause for a few years. We had the city area completed. And I spent many months on suburban areas. Oh, we did a sort of a suburban trial down around Camden way. We changed over an area there to 240. And then there was another lapse and I changed more meters. And then we started down in Helmsdale, just east of Glenelg. And by then the decision had been made that this renting people's garages and so on wasn't a very efficient thing, and we were going to put many more men onto the job, and the firm bought 4 portable trailer workshops, and the trailer workshop had a racking in it for boxes of lamps and a workbench and a couple of vices and a variable voltage transformer and a watt meter and some nice trailing leads that we hooked onto the mains wherever we went. And for 4 workshops we had 4 cars or utilities to move them around.
So the mobile workshops, when would that be, about 1937, 38?
Somewhere thereabouts, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And, we started Glenelg and went right down along the coasts, down to the edges of civilization somewhere in Marina, and then back further inland along the Marion Road, Morford Road, Marion Road roughly, and then we'd got to Goodwood in 1940. Oh yes, now going back a few stages in history, while I was at Port Adelaide, as I said, we did odd jobs for the firm when we weren't out on the road, but the evening shift, very often we would finish up quite early in the evening, some evenings. We swept the floor, that was it, that was all there was to it. So, Jack and I, between us, built a crystal set, and we didn't want to put up an aerial because we weren't going to have a license if we could possibly avoid it. But I discovered that if you came off the neutral, the establishment had a nice big double pole, I think it was a double pole, double throw switch, but anyway, a double pole knife switch that turned on and off the supply to the building. We came off the neutral of this thing through a mica condenser and a length of wire down to our table where we sat and ate, and probably earthed it onto the galvanised iron shed or something like that, and this worked like a charm. The storeman sat there and listened to the radio of an evening if he could manage it. And of course, I used to read wireless books and occasionally build things. While I was there, I started out to build myself a super deluxe high-frequency receiver. I bought from National Radio, where Jack Allen was, coil formers, the high-frequency coils out of the dual-wave sets that Jack and company were building, and the broadcast coils, and bought switch banks and made up vertical partitions of aluminium with a switch and coils mounted on it. All this was fixed together with quarter-inch brass bar and innumerable tapped screws. So I used to spend my evenings drilling and tapping brass bars and drilling aluminium panels to match and so on.
So this is making shortwave receivers or transmitters?
This was receiving. Yes. Mm. Yeah. I didn't get my AOCP until 1934 when I was back in the city, but I went to Merv Brown's code classes, and I would think that would have been before. No, wait on. I used to go to Jeff Coombe 5ML in the daytime when I was on evening shift, so obviously that was before I got my AOCP, before I had a licence, and at that stage, I think it was Bob Parasia's Flinders Radio in Flinders Street was selling type 46 valves for some nominal figure. Would you know, Cliff, about 2 and 6 each?
Yeah, it was quite low.
Yeah. Yes. Apparently the RCA Corporation had produced these two grid valves, and you could use them as a triad, an ordinary Class A triad, by connecting the outer grid to the anode.
Yes.
And they required considerable negative bias. Or if you joined the two grids together, they would work quite nicely as Class B audio tubes with no bias. The only thing was the Australian trade didn't take to them at all. Well, I bought a handful of these things and built myself a transmitter. So the way finances were, I wasn't going to buy myself a modulation transformer for plate modulation, so I used grid modulation. And that kept me going for quite a long time. But I didn't get very good reports, though. People didn't appreciate my grid modulation. Of course, it was I had no means of setting it up theoretically.
What sort of range of frequencies did you have access to in those times for amateur?
The 80 metre, 80, 40, 20, 10, 5 metres were all authorised amateur bands.
Mm.
In the early days, of course, amateurs worked on the 200 metres at the high frequency end of the broadcast band. Oh, it must have been in my high school days. I joined the Port Adelaide Radio Club, and we used to meet at the shed behind Mr. Douglas's house in Hodgman Road, Pennington. The Port Adelaide Radio Club had a receiver and a transmitter, obviously an aerial. And this transmitter was only a single tube thing, self-excited Hartley. And I'm pretty sure that it was a highly technical system of loop modulation. He used a carbon microphone and a loop of wire around the inductance. And as you spoke into the microphone, it absorbed more or less of your valuable RF energy.
Yeah.
What was left got transmitted. But anyway, the Port Adelaide Radio Club station always got very mediocre reports. And eventually, it was decided to send somebody up to Mile End, to Vic Coombe, the West Suburban Radio Club, because his transmitter worked all right, and as far as we could see, he had the similar type of equipment. And the guy came back and pointed out that the West Suburban Radio Club's UV-210 glowed much brighter than ours did. Well, they were lighting the filament, which was 7.5 volts at 1.25 amps, I think. They were lighting it with an 8 volt, 1 amp bell transformer, and obviously the bell tranny wasn't putting out anywhere near 8 volts. So some bright spark unplugged the 210 and plugged the 201A in and changed the filament connection down to the 5 volt winding. The 201A only pulled 0.25 amp, so it got its 5 volts. Transmitter worked real well with the 201A in it. I don't know how long the 201A was going to live, though.
They were 2.5 volt tubes, weren't they? The 201As?
No, it was a 5 volt tube.
Heater.
Heaven knows why. Why would they pick on 5 volts? Well, of course, you could work it off a 6-volt car battery,
yes,
which was the traditional American motor car standard voltage.
Yes.
Gave you a bit of margin for voltage loss.
Okay, well, sometime you got into radio for the rest of your career. Could you just sort of give us an idea of how that came about, when it was, and in the broadcasting area? You're still with ETSA, aren't you, at the moment? You're still with the...
ETSA, yes.
Well, what was it?
Well,
what
in the course of our changeover, we went through the Glenelg, Somerton, Brighton area, and down there lived Johnny DeCure, assistant radio inspector. Mm. Well, I thought I'd now do the decent thing by Johnny. One Sunday afternoon, just when we were getting somewhere near his place, I went down to talk to him and point out to him that somebody like me was going to turn up and look into all his radio equipment and did he have anything that he specially valued and so on. And we talked. In the course of conversation, Johnny wanted to know, was I happy in the job I was doing? Well, I was a little disgruntled. When we were in the city, I was the radio man. The other blokes did most of the motors and things like that, and I did most of the radio sets. Alan Phillips joined the staff, but when we got out in the suburbs, there were 4 workshops, so we had 4 radio men. And one of these guys, named Alan Hunter, he came from some radio repair shop. So the powers that be nominated him as the callback complaint-fixing man. So that sort of put me down a step.
Mm.
I wasn't really thrilled about that, but you know, there was no formal promotion scheme with the supply company. If the boss liked the way you went about things, you got promotion. If you trod on his toes, you didn't get promotion. So when Johnny asked me, was I happy, I hummed and ahed a bit, and he said, well, it's like this. The PMG department, broadcasting section, are going to advertise some vacancies in the near future. You'll have to sit for an exam, and if you reckon you can do well in the exam, you might get one of these jobs. So I said, well, I've got nothing much to lose. Actually, my last year's tax return was £280 with the supply company, and if I could get one of these jobs, I would start with the PMG department on £208 a year with the prospect of promotion or, well, increasing salary up to £288 a year. Well, I thought that was a worthwhile thing. Anyway, Johnny didn't have any data with him at all. He said, ring me Monday morning and I'll read you the stuff out of the Gazette. So I duly took a few minutes off and went, found a public phone and rang Johnny, and he said, look boy, if you want this job, you'll have to stir your feathers a bit. It closes today in Canberra. Now look, I'll dictate a telegram for you. If you've got some paper and pencil, I'll dictate a telegram for you. You send the telegram to the address that I give you, and the telegram will say written application following. So Julie, I copied this down, found a post office and sent this telegram, and I suppose the next day I picked up the papers from Johnny's home, filled them in, and away they went. Well, I went to Frank O'Grady's lectures. He told us a lot of valuable stuff. Months went past and the exam came along. More months went past. War was declared. And I sort of lost interest in this thing. I thought it was a dead duck. And lo and behold, I used to go and look at the Government Gazette in the post office occasionally, and in one of these gazettes there was the result of this exam. I'd done reasonably well in it. Where are we? Pat Giddings, Al Smythe, Albert W. Taylor, and then myself, top of the Commonwealth list. I reckon that wasn't real bad. And more months went past. So I said, war was declared and things were a bit upset. So I plodded on with the supply company, and I get a blanky telegram when I get home one day. Please report and your appointment under clause summary had been approved. Please report at your earliest convenience. So I probably talked to Johnny DeCure and then to Frank O'Grady, and finished up. It got around to Friday lunchtime when I at last made up my mind that I was going to take this job. So I got a leave of absence from my superior and rode my motorbike into Hilton, fronted up to my immediate boss, the meter foreman in charge of testing and things, and said, please, Mr. Cheeseman, I can get another job. I would like to leave the company. I don't think it upset him unduly. I said, also, normally I would think you would like to get a week or so's notice, but on the other hand, the firm owes me a fortnight's holiday. So please can I start my holidays on Monday, Mr. Cheeseman? And he thought that over for a while. I said, I don't see why not. You're entitled to your holidays. So away I went. Monday morning I turned up in post office place for the PMG's department.
Still on holidays.
Yes, April 1940 was an interesting month as far as I was concerned. I left the supply company, I bought a house, and I arranged to get married. And I did get married. went to Melbourne for my honeymoon, and the car broke down, and I shipped it back to Adelaide on the boat and came home on the train. Moved into our happy home in Carnarvon Parade, and we've been there practically ever since.
Great.
Yes. Well, as I say, I started in Post Office Place, the transmission section it was in those days. It was in the basement of the Commonwealth buildings, so I called it anyway, in Post Office Place. I think it's still unfinished, that building, is it? Post Office Place?
Seems like it.
Half a building with 5AN's tower on top of it.
Did you start when they had all the timber reinforcing in there?
I should think so. Yeah, well, I'm not sure about the transmission lab, but I know Central Exchange was all buttressed up with timber. Mm. Yes. Yes, and of course, from 1936 onwards, I'd been walking the streets of Adelaide and suburbs in broad daylight, and we'd been working 5.5 days a week, 8 to 5 nominally, and the PMG department's only working 5 days a week for the same hours. So we started, I think, 7:30 in the morning. In April, it was only barely daylight to my ideas at 7:30 in the morning. I think we had 3/4 of an hour for lunch, and we finished, Cliff?
7:45 to 5:33.
I'd get out in the streets, and the sun had been nearly setting again. That was a bit of a shock to the system. Anyway, my friend Bert Taylor and I were handed over to Fred Sellier, the senior technician. The firm had a telegraph system which should have been 10 telegraph channels, Adelaide to Perth, two ways. And it only had, I think, 6 channels working. So Fred was commissioned to build 4 more channels. And this thing worked what I would have called higher audio frequency, somewhere in the region of, it must have been higher than 3 and 3 kilohertz, because the speech channels went up to 3, so it was probably between 4 and 6 kilohertz. And of course, the wiring was all beautifully laid out in forms and bundled up. It's all factory style. The components were sort of halfway between audio and radio. The filter coils, for instance, were mu metal to try and get the highest Q. Fred had acquired sufficient inductors to make up the filters. We built these things and installed them. Since I'd worked in the GPO not very long before, I knew my way around the place. I worked in the GPO on the DC to AC change, and again on the 210 to 240 volt change, so I had a fair idea of it. So we built that and installed it. Well, installed the Adelaide end. Oh yes, and when I started in this job, I was a mechanic broadcasting. It was a bit of a surprise to find I was in this bally basement and building carrier telegraph equipment, and I'd allowed for the fact that there was a transmitter at Crystal Brook. That wasn't too far out in the Mulga. Besides, that was my mother's home country. But after a while, I discovered people like Cliff Mole would be packing toolboxes and collecting bundles of wires, boxes of insulators, equipment racks and so on, and they would disappear. And I say, well, where's Cliff gone? And where's Laurie Zerby gone? Oh, he's gone to Nadano to do a job, or he's gone to Mount Gambier. He'll be back in a fortnight. That was the thing I hadn't allowed for. It wasn't not part of my philosophy. I had a good enough run. I had 1 or 2 arguments with Ted McGrath about going to Mount Gambier for 3 months in the middle of winter. But anyway, Well, after we got this Class B telegraph thing, Class B, after we got this telegraph thing on
the line. It was called a Type B, I think.
Type B telegraphs, yes. Instantly it transmitted tone to line, and at the far end the tone was received and rectified and operated a telegraph relay.
Great.
A very elementary device. About there somewhere I got down to the studios. And got introduced to control room operating. And once again, as I say, the war was on. I got disturbed from the studios occasionally. I had one spell at the trunk test desk. Cry. I was heartily glad to get away from the trunk desk, but they had just about every known variety of communication system there in its day. I can remember in my electric supply company days reading a note. Back in those days, they had just introduced a standardised system and a grid distribution system in Great Britain. Yeah. Some motor manufacturer was known to say that, thank heavens, they only made electric motors with two directions of rotation. They ordered them from his factory with all the known variations of voltage, frequency, size and everything else, but thank heaven they only went either clockwise or anti-clockwise. Well, the trunk test desk was a bit that way. Some places you called with a magneto ringer, some places you called with a 135 cycle, and some places you called with a 1,000 cycle, and some places you called with a 1,000 cycle interrupted at 16.
And
some places you dialed. Oh, strike me pink. Now, it's all very nice if you read about these things in the book, but when you've got a great test and patch panel with about 10 bays in it, you walk up to one and poke the plug in the hole and press the 16-cycle ringer key and it doesn't respond. Think that over. Where do I go from here?
Had you had any training in this area?
No. Yeah. Train on the job.
Right.
Oh, I admit the blokes that were on the job were helpful sort of guys. You know, I'd be standing there wondering now, just what do I call Malang with? And the bloke next door would say, Malang, build 16-cycle ringer. Well, away I'd go. I suppose I was only on holiday relief, so I gave three rousing cheers when I got back to the studios.
Were the studios in Hyde Park Square in those
days?
Yes,
yeah. Yes. Where are we? We had one, two, three... three studios in the oldest building and two studios in what used to be the Sunday school building, and they were just equipping the studio in the old church building, which was to become the orchestral and live artist studio. All the equipment was AC operated. When we did our changeover in that area, we just struck it lucky. Ted McGrath had rebuilt the equipment there just a few months before we came along, so everybody knew what was what. Everything was pretty well standardised. They did their own adjustments there. That was a pushover from my point of view. Whereas when we came to 5KA, of course, they didn't do things like that. It finished up... The day of the changeover, we arranged with the mains department to change that building over overnight. I assume that he gave us a temporary feed, and I went in, and Charlie Taraha, a New Zealander member of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I climbed in and out of the transmitter and the studio equipment and changed the taps on the transformers, started her up on the 240-volt supply, and it worked. So I went home and went to bed.
The transformers had tappings for a range of supplies in those times.
Oh, yes, they'd been... I should tell you, the eastern states all had 235 or 240 volt supplies. Oh, where have I got there? Oh, yes, at the studios I graduated to outside broadcast. And in those days we had disc recorders. And due to the time difference between Sydney and Perth, we used to record a few items, things like the overseas news, for instance, would come to us from Sydney at, say, 7:30 our time, 8 o'clock Eastern. And we'd put this on a disc, and then an hour and a half, or 2 hours after we'd recorded it, we would play it to Perth. Of course, once again, you learnt things on the job. And the first night I was introduced to this, Bob Hamilton, the senior tech, watched over me, and I got a disc out of the store and put it on and did a test cut on it and recorded the night's news. Dumb-like, the next night I got another disc out, put it on and recorded the night's news. And when Bob went to write it up in the book, instead of having two news episodes on one disc, we only had one on each of the two discs. So he decided that sort of square the book somehow, we would transfer this second news service from the second disc to the unused side of the first disc. But unfortunately it didn't work. The swarf went under the cutter or something like that. Threw the cutter out and left a break in the groove, so we had to write that disc off. All went to engineering expenses.
And what about the country? Did you eventually go to the country with
Yes. After quite a fair time at the studios, I got... Oh, yes, I suppose 1941... Cliff got himself involved in air radio installations in the northern South Australia and the Northern Territory, and things were not going too well. They bombed Darwin and things like that, yeah. And there was an urgent call for more manpower. So I got called back from the studios to the transmission in Post Office Place. And a party of us were sent up to Daly Waters, where Cliff and these men, I was going to say merry men, but they were far from merry. They had real trouble.
We're very glad to see you.
Yeah, my word. I spent the best part of a month, chappy name of Ken Binky and I, with the line party, spent best part of a month installing magneto telephones, nailing them to tent poles and gum trees and so on, for the Air Force. The Air Force had transferred to Daly Waters in a great hurry, and they wanted telephones. So Ken and I did that, while Cliff and Jack Judd and Ray Baldock worked on the radio side. I think I did a bit on the radio, but not very much.
You took over at the time that the radio beacon was to be installed. That was an extra.
Yeah.
We had the communication in by then, two transmitters and quite a pack of receivers.
Yeah. Yes.
These are for the RAF. Are they all broadcast?
Well, it was allegedly for civil aviation, but we didn't know who we were working for. It was directed by the Department of Air, but we're still getting our pay from the post office.
Yes.
So are we talking about shortwave transmitters there?
It was long wave as well.
Yes.
333 kilohertz.
Yes.
Yep. Right. Yes. This 333 kilohertz, I went out to Parafield one day. Somebody told me there was a radio communication to the aeroplanes out there, and away out in the far corner of the drome, there was a little hut about 9 by 9, and then there was a transmitter and a receiver working on 333. You could, if you had a good constitution, you could hear Melbourne and you could hear the aircraft, but somebody around the place was crushing rocks with a hard, heavy hammer. Oh, the static was terrific.
Gee.
Oh, hell. But anyway, coming back to 1941, I went to Daly Waters, and Cliff came back to Adelaide, and we moved down to Tennant Creek with the Line Party and Ray Baldock. Jack Judd, I think, had got himself up to Larimar, and Ken Binkie and myself, and we installed air radio communication at Tennant Creek. A DCA operator drove his car from Melbourne via Mount Isa up to Tennant Creek. Oh yes, we'd set the gear up with the operator sitting at the desk and looking out through the windows onto the field. The DCA man objected to this. He didn't want to sit there gazing out at that glaring tropical sunlight all day. So we turned the operator's desk around so he sat with his back to the glare. I'll admit that it was probably easier on his eyes, and it lit the receiver panels much better. The only thing was his transmitters, his receivers were on his left hand now instead of on his right. But anyway, we installed the thing. The transmitter was a second-hand transmitter. It had been bounced down the road from Darwin, which didn't do it any good. And it had a multitude of little motors that drove variable inductors and variable capacitors and changed tappings and so on. Rotten little sods of things. Ray Nottage and I would go around and clean all the contacts and lubricate all the motors and go over it, and the thing was dial controlled from the receiving position. We'd dial up all the numbers and the thing would work like a charm. We'd put the covers on it, go back and do something else, go back to the receiver site and start wiring there. Come out next morning and just for fun we'd dial a few numbers and the rotten thing wouldn't come up with the right number. So we'd go back and clean it all over again. Oh, happy days. I think we got the better of it in the finish.
Who would have made these transmitters?
AWA. Mm. They were all amalgamated, weren't they, Cliff?
Yes, that's right. Oh, until the beacons went in, they were American Airco.
Yes, yeah. Mm. And when we got the thing completed, or very nearly completed, Andy Harrower, the Department of Air man, drove his motor. No, I don't think he drove his car. He went back to Melbourne anyway. And one night, I, with some moral assistance from Ray Nottage, started up VTZ or whatever, VTC or whatever its call sign was, and called VML, tested the heap on all frequencies to and from Melbourne. The first time I'd ever tested an air radio station. Right. I must admit, now, it was a bit of a thing, and my telegraphy was never very good. But anyway, we made it. And about there, the line part of the technicians slept in the air radio building in relative comfort. And the line party camped and got their camping allowance. I suppose we still got our camping allowance. But when the line party left, we went back and lived in the Goldfields Hotel. And we used to walk to and fro morning and lunch and evening. The weather was nice and warm, so we used to walk to and fro in only shorts and a pair of boots. And I came home with a beautiful suntan. The only time in my life, I think, when I've ever been really suntanned. Anyway, eventually the job... Oh, yes, the PMG department decided to put a repeater on the north-south carrier equipment at Tennant Creek. So they sent Brian Blundell up, and Brian was a power man. He knew all about it. And I think Ray Nottage had left us. Ken Binkie got roped in first of all to go down and help Brian. Oh, Brian endeared himself to us. A fair amount of the work was in screwed conduit, and old Brian had put a piece of conduit in the pipe vise and get the pipe dies and give the dies a couple of turns. And Ken, now give her a turn or two while I get my pipe going, Ken. by the time he'd got his pipe going, Ken would have an inch of thread on the pipe. And Brian would say, yes, that's enough, Ken, and take the dies off, pick up the piece of pipe and go away and fit it. And anyway, eventually we got the repeater station completed and working, so I came back to Adelaide. That was the end of my tropical adventure. Yes, well, I don't remember just what I did in the next few months. That was about August 1942. About March 1943, I got sick of Dodge and Ted McGrath and his ambition to send me to places like Mount Gambier. There came a vacancy at Crystal Brook, so I applied for this vacancy and duly got transferred up there. Got a reasonable house to live in, got sufficient petrol to be able to run my motor car again. It had been up on blocks ever since 1941. And there we were, Crystal Brook.
As the sort of technical person looking after the station.
Yes, yeah. There were three technicians on shift and a supervisor.
Right.
He worked day shift. In the big scare when the Japs first came into the war, they dug two air raid shelters, one between the road and the transmitter building and another one behind the transmitter building, and they'd put up blast protection palisades on the four sides of the building, so that there was very much wartime conditions. And when I got there, the rabbits had decided to move into these air raid shelters. Well, I bought a rifle, the first time in my life I'd ever owned a rifle, and I used to drive in the front gate, and if there was any rabbits running around, I'd stop and load the rifle and wait till I saw a rabbit sitting where I reckoned I could hit him, shoot him, pick him up and take him up, take charge of the establishment, let the other bloke go home, and then I'd skin and clean this blakey rabbit, and we'd have rabbit for tea. The only trouble was the rabbits didn't stay there very long, people doing things like that to them.
It was 5CK all AC operated by that time?
Yes.
Rid of the motor generators.
Yeah, the motor generators were still there, but Pat Giddings and Al Smythe had been there and converted it. The original 5CK transmitter, as it came, I'm not quite sure whether the essential parts came from England or whether it was made in Australia, but it was an English design.
Yeah. SDC.
Yes. And it had DC, I think, on all the filaments. And it started off with a long string of not ordinary receiving tubes, rather specialised SDC receiving tubes for crystal oscillators and first buffers and second buffers and drivers and so on. And then it got to a 50-watt tube as a modulated RF amp. And that was modulated with a thundering great 250-watt triode, a thing about 12 inches high and 3 inches in diameter. And then after that, there were two linear amplifiers. The first one was a great big air-cooled triode, and the last linear was a pair of water-cooled triodes in parallel. And I think it was Al Smythe and Pat Giddings doing, there was a third tube mounted there in a jacket with water circulating, so that if you lost a final amp tube, you only had to drop off for a minute or two and wang over the filament switches and let the tube warm up, and you were back on the air again. Whereas previously, if you lost a final tube, you either went without until the end of the day, or you had to take the station off there and change a tube, which would have been at least half an hour. Oh, yes, and these two eminent gentlemen, I don't know whether they had much supervision, but the thing was also protected against enemy infiltration. There were a couple of booby traps which you had to clear every morning when you came in, and a couple of things that you set up when you went out. But you having cleared them, you switched on the main switch, which started up the water pumps and livened up all the filaments. And there was a thermal time delay which operated a relay. And if you were a well-behaved citizen, you waited until this really clunked in, and then you put on the first step of the high tension, and then you waited a bit longer till the water-cooled tubes were warmed up, and then you put on the final step of the extra high tension. And then there was a barbarous idea. They changed the taps on the extra high tension transformer primary. And it's all very nice. You turned this great wheel and you broke one set of contacts, and of course the filter condensers discharged while you were turning this thing. So when you closed the final set of contacts, you were hitting these massive great bank of capacitors right from dead cold practically, and quite frequently there was a surge on the line and the main breaker would drop out. I mean, that was a barbarous device. But of course, having to live with this infernal thing, it was pointed out to me as soon as I got there that the thing was, if you dropped the main circuit breaker, you whipped out and poked in the main circuit breaker and came back and wanged in the filament switch as quickly as possible, and then you opened the cage and whipped in and slammed this relay shut, and it locked shut.
Yeah.
And then you closed the cage and belted around the front and started pushing buttons madly. And you were back on the air in about 30 seconds, 20 seconds if you had your running shoes on.
Yeah.
So,
what sort of voltage would the transformers have had, or the tubes
the
have had?
The final stage had 12,000.
12,000, yeah.
At somewhere about an amp anode current.
Mm.
Anyway, this persisted until after the war, and once again Brian Blundell appeared on the scene. He was going to bring the thing up to date. I must admit that while Brian was there, we got a very good thing. Instead of changing the taps, we started up with resistors in series, as had been done at 5CL many years before, so that when you closed the switch for the extra high tension, you started up with resistors in the primary.
Mm.
So if you did get a flashover anywhere, you didn't get a dead short. And also, when you pressed the next push button, you short-circuited those resistors, so the final HT went up from about 8,000 to 12, and it didn't cause a ghastly great surge on the mains.
Mm.
It was very much better. And once again, Brian didn't endear him to the staff. He liked to go and have his afternoon tea just about the time we were getting the transmitter back on the air again after working on it.
Did you have a spare transmitter in those times? Or?
No, not in your life.
It was just
one anyway. Transmitter. From the time I first went there up until I was thinking I left there in 1943. Yep. So up until about I've got my figures mixed somewhere. I went there in 1942, and I was there for nominally 3 years, so I left there at the end of 1945, so it was post-war. So I would think that shortly after the end of the war, 5CK was on continuously from 6 a.m. to midnight, whereas during the early period we'd had a morning break of an hour and a half or so, during which break we used to do quite a bit of maintenance. I can recall one or two occasions when we let the aerial down for maintenance, and it got around to 25 past 11 and we still hadn't got it off the ground, and you madly get to work and winch it up until at least nothing was touching the ground. By then somebody would have the transmitter ready to go. As soon as everything was clear of the ground, somebody would put power on. It was a well-behaved old transmitter, that. It didn't protest about things like that being done to it. Anyway, in 1945, the owner of the house I lived in came back from the war, and he wanted his house to live in. So he found me another house out on the edge of the town. Well, it was livable. That's about all you could say for it. I parked my car in a big machinery shed that was all of 100 yards away from the house. And my old Fiat, it didn't take nicely to frosty mornings. Quite a few winter mornings, after a while, of course, I got it down to a system. But at first, I used to go out and try and start the old heap, and it wouldn't start. So I'd go back inside and boil a jug of water, and walk out and pour it over the intake manifold and bring the jug back and put it in the kitchen. By the time I got back, the intake manifold would be warm and away I'd go. Oh, happy days. But anyway, eventually, this house I was living in was sold to another ex-service man, so I left Crystal Brook just before Christmas 1946, started back at the studios in 1947, and I started again as a technician in the switch room, which was approaching, what would you say, Cliff, a slightly above the average ranking position?
It was considered that, yes.
And in due course I became acting senior, and a lot of the staff in those days were returned servicemen, so that the acting senior had to get off his tail and do a bit occasionally. I can remember one occasion we were doing a live on the air schools broadcast, and the cue was given, and in those days we used to switch the transmitters to the studio that was originating the program. And in those days too we had uni selectors for switchings, and they didn't always go where they were supposed to, but anyway, on this occasion I know the switches drove all right, and up in the studio they played the theme music all right, but that's all I got, excepting a few curious noises, bits of hum and clicking noises and so on. So I scream out of the switch room and down the corridor and up the stairs and into the control booth, and the director of the spoken word, I think his title was there, and the local producer and the operator said, "I can't get anything out of the microphone." So I grab another microphone and a coil of cable and rush inside and change the microphone, have a look at the control minister, scratch the mic. No, all right, I changed the cable. She worked. Away they went. I believe afterwards the director of spoken word asked the local producer, did he often start his sessions like that? We didn't lose very much time. But he had to be prepared to do things like that in those days.
Were the promotion positions given to returned servicemen rather than the people who'd been carrying on during the war?
No. The promotion, to get an official promotion, you should have passed an exam, a written theory and a practical exam. I got my standing as an acting senior tech on experience and service. Now, why not? No, I had passed. While I was at Crystal Brook, I did a fair amount of study. Once again, when you're sitting at the transmitter and you've got a well-behaved transmitter, you can afford to read theory books and things like this. And while I was at Crystal Brook, after the war, the first senior technician's exams were gazetted, the first exams since the beginning of the war, and I sat for senior technician radio and senior technician telephone. So I came back to the studios with two qualifications.
Right.
So it was just a matter of getting the paperwork completed, and I became a fully appointed senior technician.
If we could go back a little, you mentioned earlier about doing a course at the School of Mines. How far did you get with that?
Not very far, actually. The first 2 years was reasonably easy because I was working at Hilton, and it was relatively easy to get from Hilton to the School of Mines.
Yes.
And it wasn't terribly difficult, especially once I'd got myself a motorbike, to get from home at Alwood and up to the School of Mines. But when I got transferred to Port Adelaide, I was on shift work. And the first year, I managed to wangle it. That I know I did fitting and turning alternately evening and morning, and I did drawing alternate morning and evening. And somewhere thereabouts, they altered the syllabus, which meant that my Mathematics 1 qualification, which I'd got, was useless.
Mm.
So I had to do preparatory Math 3, which included calculus. And I think that I managed to do that alternate day and night classes with George Haskard.
Oh, yes.
But I wasn't madly enthusiastic. I was becoming more interested in radio.
Yes.
And it got to the... I'd run out of the firm's time, so that I was doing all this in my own time. And it began to dawn upon me that if I was going to get this qualification, it was going to take me several years. I think it was a four-year full-time course.
Mm.
And the brighter boys that we went to high school with had got themselves jobs in the office, and particularly at North Terrace in those days was the office and the drawing office design department.
Mm.
So that it was fairly, apparent to me that I wasn't going to make the grade into this exalted region, so I dropped out of it.
So these exams at the PMG, as it was then, ran, they didn't depend on you having prior qualifications, though?
No.
Just experience and some basic.
Yeah. I was looking last night, in 1936, the School of Mines ran a course on electronics, and I went along to this course. And it was an electronic course. They introduced me to things like the work function required to persuade electrons to leave a hot filament, things like this. But whereas I had a fairly good grip of practical use of vacuum tubes and things, these guys, and quite a lot of the guys from the drawing office turned up because they were being introduced to electronic things like reclosing of circuit breakers and so on were being done electronically.
Yeah.
And of course they didn't really understand the language.
Mm.
It was rather a mixed up sort of a class. So, some of the, they ate up the electrical theory, whereas I was struggling was the more practical sides of it. It was a pushover to me, it was elementary, and to them it was something new.
Yes.
Like we got involved in a discussion at one class, and the Americans' screen grid valves had the grid on the top and the anode on the base.
Yes.
Whereas Phillips and the European people, they put the anode on the top and the grid on the base. Now, why did they do this? And nobody had any answer.
No. Somewhere along the line, you joined the IRWE, or probably the IRE.
1956,
right.
Yeah. Yes.
That was when you were in the studios that time. Yes.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Oh, yes. I came back from Crystal Brook 1947. I was studio operating up until 1950. And I presume I got a bit sick of shift work or something, and I found that I was... Did I take over from Cliff Mile? I took over from Les Pridham, I think, on studio installation, which was a day work job.
Mm.
And this was something different. There was quite a lot of work being done, and I stayed on that for a few years. I got back to radio section had been divided into Radio 1 and Radio 2. One section dealt with the high frequency transmission and reception and VHF.
Yes.
And the other section dealt with the broadcast frequency stuff.
Mm.
And I shuttled to and fro between installation at the studio and installation at Franklin Street Engineering Building between 50 and 56. In 1956, Charlie Ansell, who was Super Tech Brooklyn Park, took 6 months long leave and went to England and Europe. Charlie Thane from Radio Installation went down to Brooklyn Park because he lived down there. So I took over from Charlie Thane at Franklin Street, and that was the year of the Olympic Games, and that was the year that we installed 5 PA Panola 2-kilowatt transmitter, and that was the year we started the installation of 5 MV 2-kilowatt transmitter in the Renmark Studios, which I was very happy to be handling. That was a bright spot in my career.
Yes, very good.
Once again,
how are we going for time there? Maybe, Bill, you could go on and give us a bit of a resume of what happened from, say, the 1956 era to the time that you finished as a working man.
Yes, my memory is not nearly as organised from 1956 onwards. Most of the time I was at the studios. Oh, yes, after the two Charlies got back to their normal position, Keith Gladstone Wright retired medically unfit from the studios, and I got appointed to his position, Super Tech on shift at the studios. And I stayed there most of the time. Oh, yes, I used to relieve at Crystal Brook occasionally too, particularly from 1947 up to 56. That was as good as a holiday to go back there. On some occasions, we exchanged houses. I lived in the house at Crystal Brook, and the bloke I was relieving lived in our house. But anyway, from 1956 onwards, I was mainly at the studios on shift work. There was a short period when I was acting engineer up in the Franklin Street office, and I think that was the one period Cliff Mole had initiated the thought of a transistorized switching system, that by cutting off or supplying base current to a transistor, you could make it open circuit or close, or, well, conducting, and this was a clickless switching system. So I went up and spent considerable time trying to measure the crosstalk or leakage when you had 40 of these contraptions all connected together and things like this. And we built a switching rack. Up to that time, we had tape recordings, and we used to patch the output of a tape recording room to a particular control booth where it would be aired. And of course, inevitably, occasionally somebody would forget to put in the patch, and there would be a hold up, which was a reportable offence. And we installed this rack of switching equipment, transistorised and push button controlled, and it worked like a charm. It was clickless, it was free from crosstalk. The only thing was, there were one or two occasions, I don't know just how long we used that thing, but it went for several years. There were just one or two occasions when we got a dry joint or something like this, and we lost control of the base current on a row of transistors, and they would all turn on to a certain extent, and you would get all the programs imaginable, all linked together. Oh, God. The first time this happened, of course, the technician and I looked at one another and said, it can't be. Oh, what can it be? Since I'd had a hand in the design of this thing, I knew a bit more than the other guy did about what was on it. And, well, first of all, obviously the stuff was taken off the air. We grabbed a armful of patch cords and patched everything up and then sat down to think about it and eventually worked it out, that it was limited to a certain inlet or a certain outlet.
Yes.
And we traced it back and eventually found that we had no control of the base currents in that particular line of transistors, and found the wiring fault of sorts, soldered it, and away we went again for another year or two. Oh, that was a beautiful system.
You mentioned Bert Taylor a couple of times.
Yes.
Where was he while you were at the studios? Was he at the studios also?
He was at the studios practically all the time from the July 1940 when we finished our telegraph up until he left the PMG department to go out to Salisbury. I think he worked with one of the private companies there.
That's right, yes.
Which would have been 1956 too. And Bert didn't stay very long out there. Well, my friend Bert Taylor started at the studios in 1940 when we finished that telegraph equipment, and he was there almost continuously until he left to go out to Salisbury to the weapons research establishment. And I think he worked very enthusiastically out there on this new project and wore himself down so that by the end of 1956 he was back again in the PMG department for a short time. But from there, I'm pretty sure he transferred to the radio trade school, as it was in those days.
Yes.
What, auxiliary to the School of Mines?
No, I think it was a separate section set up by the Education Department under Eric Manoel.
Eric was involved in it.
Earlier you mentioned doing disc recording. Were you involved with wire recorders in between there and the tape?
We had a few wire recorders, yes. They were mainly used for outside broadcast purposes. Our wire recorders, anyway, had a peculiar characteristic. There was this rustling noise not very far down in the background due to the wire running over the recording head. But, you know, for an outside broadcast job, they were very good.
Yes.
The quality was not quite as good as it could have been, but it was light, portable, reliable. If by some foolishness you broke the wire, you just tied a knot in it and pressed on.
Right.
And then, of course, we eventually got a pair of EMI broadcast tape recorders, which ran at 30 inches a second. Got through something like 3,960 feet of tape in 22 minutes. And 22 minutes was an awkward thing because most of our sessions ran half an hour,
yes.
So you had a joint in it. And the changeover facilities were a bit elementary in those days. But still, they were a notable piece of machine. They went for years. The heads wore, but it didn't seem to spoil the performance at all. Then we got portable quarter-inch tape machines, magnacorders and Pyrox. And then we got later vintages of EMI broadcast recorders.
Have you got any other questions, any interesting points that you're aware of, Cliff, that you might like to put to Bill? Or?
Oh, I can't think of anything offhand, Bill. I think you've covered it very well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what was originally Studio Number 1 in the early days became Studio 510 for light orchestral items, and in the shuffling of this studio, the control booth wasn't in a very good position, and people complained about this. You couldn't see one corner of the studio, and we wanted to install more equipment. Particularly, we wanted to put a couple of tape recorders in the studio, so that in the original design there'd been an audience gallery. So we got this audience gallery rebuilt as a control booth and recording room. That was a major advantage. And Studio 520, the old church building, the same thing occurred there. We had a control booth and a relatively small window, and we got a new control room built. As part of the wartime precautions, they'd built a spectator gallery out of very solid concrete, and we got our new control booth and recorder room built on top of that. which gave us a marvellous view of the studio, and new desks. Generally, that was a great improvement.
Mm.
Well, then, somewhere around about the 1960 mark, our transistor switching for tape replays had been a great success. The design department set to work to build us a new switching unit for station switching. And this incorporated a crossbar switch and thyristors, if I remember correctly. From my point of view, I never really understood how it worked, but it did work. It was duly installed. It had many advantages. It was a modern piece of design. Just once now and then, something would come unstuck. I think most of the people, when it lost its marbles, they just switched the battery power off for the whole establishment, switched it on again and pressed the buttons, and usually away it went.
Yeah.
Heaven knows why. Well then, ever since the start of things, when the Australian Broadcasting Company took over from the private Class A station licensee, the PMG department provided the technical facilities. For the Australian Broadcasting Commission, they provided the facilities. But then in 1956 came television, and the Australian Broadcasting Commission got control of the studios in the technical area. And having done that, they thought, well, they had been trying for years to get control of the radio studio facilities too. And in 1964, the studio radio technical staff were handed over to the Australian Broadcasting Commission. So I was now paid by the ABC.
Yeah.
Oh yes, and in the meantime I got myself promoted from shift super tech, one of three, up to the supervising technician in charge. So there I was.
Hmm. And were you still with them when they shifted to Collinswood?
Yes, I was. Yes, in 1964 we acquired ABC engineers, a Class 3 engineer, I think, Staunton McNamara, and two Class 1 engineers, one of whom was design and technical standards.
Mm.
And in 1970, this gentleman, Peter Gonder, and I were seconded to start work on the design of equipment for the new studio. So I went out to Collinswood. Peter and I inhabited a disused talk studio out there and proceeded to think about what we were going to put in the new building and look at the new building. And, of course, time had marched on. We had solid-state control desks. In Hindmarsh Square, we had two relatively large and complex solid-state control desks for live artist work, and the replay switching and things of that nature. But out at Collinswood, everything was solid-state. And in Hindmarsh Square, following ancient PMG practice, we used a lot of iron cord transformers to prevent out of balance and longitudinal currents and things. Peter had great faith that a dual input chip was capable of resisting out of balance and longitudinal currents, so the Collinswood equipment had practically no iron cord transformers in it. I think we installed a few transformers in the telecom lines, although I think up to the time I left we were still sending direct to line, because I'd put the case to telecom that all our equipment was battery operated, it wasn't mains operated, and therefore it was low voltage equipment and it posed no danger to the telecom lines. So why should we put transformers in? So I worked with Peter for about a year, and we got out the format of the desk, the way it should be mechanically constructed, and the facilities on it, considerable conferring with announcers and booth operators and so on. And then I went back to Hindmarsh Square again. And in 1973, we moved out to Collinswood. We had a closing down ceremony in Hindmarsh Square. I moved out to Collinswood, and there I stayed until I retired in 1976.
Great. Oh, that's good. Thank you very much for that, Bill.